Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to a look back at the year that was on the Kelly Alexander Show. We were so fortunate to have so many awesome guests, and on this episode, you'll hear from singer, songwriter, and actress Macy Gray, not to mention crime victim organization founder Alexis Moore, talking about how to keep your kids safe from cyberbullying. We chat about dealing with change with Ariane de Beauvoisin and wrap things up with a new remix from Britney Spears, Alien.
Capture your need for sound.
It's a huge thrill to welcome to the show Grammy Award-winning artist Macy Gray. Macy, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly.
So, Macy, it seems like I'm good, and we're so excited to have you on the show. We're big fans of you here on the show, and I wanted to ask you, it seems like you're constantly on tour doing shows, performances. Do you feel most at home when you're on stage?
Yeah, I've been performing for a long time, so that's probably, you know, a lot of comfort to me. So, yeah, I enjoy it.
You've also had an eclectic career. You're not only writing and recording music and being, you know, a recording artist, but you're also an actress. Do you prefer one to the other, or do you like both creative aspects of, you know, acting and singing and performing?
No, I'm in love with music. That's what I do the best. And that's what, you know, that comes really, really naturally to me. So, but, you know, I love making movies, and I'm actually doing a part at the end of the year, a part called Cardboard Box, which I'm really excited about. So it's just a different craft, but, you know, most people do more than one thing well, you know.
Do you have any actors or singers that you look up to and that have influenced you throughout your career, or at least sort of set you on your way and gave you a good idea about maybe what you wanted to accomplish in the music industry?
You mean that I knew personally, or just...
Either way, by example, or maybe, you know, some recording artists that you met along the way and were like, you know, cool, I like that vibe.
I met Diana Ross a long time ago. She's pretty much my idol. I think her career was perfect, and she's perfect, and I'm just a huge Diana Ross fan.
What would be playing in your iPod right now if we were to take a listen?
This new song that I just recorded a couple weeks ago. I was just listening to it to see if I still like it.
do you?
I do, actually.
That's awesome. I wanted to speak to you about your album covers. It's got, you know, a lot of variety in there. You're doing versions of songs from Metallica all the way over to Kanye West. How did you actually decide which songs that you wanted to cover?
Mostly, for starters, I was always huge fans of those songs. So that was, you know, just that I knew the songs inside and out. That was first. And then, you know, most songs that you're fans of, you're fans because of, you know, not only the music, but, you know, something in the lyric you relate to, or something that you always remember, or you remember where you were the first time you heard it, stuff like that. So those were just songs that were like close to me personally for some reason, and definitely the lyrics was a big part of it, because I had to perform it, so the lyrics had to mean something to me personally in order for me to put truth in it, you know what I mean? So that was probably just a personal connection was the biggest thing for me.
I wanted to actually speak to you about lyrics and your songs and how important they are to your fans, because you have a bucket load of fans, and a lot of your songs speak to us. And what does it feel like when, you know, one of your fans comes up to you and says, you know, that song or that lyric just, you know, either helped me get through the day, or, you know, it made me feel like someone understands me? Like, how does that make you feel as an artist to know that you have connected so much to your listening audience?
It's sweet because you know, when I'm making music, I'm not really thinking about, you know, that, like I'm not going in there saying, I really want, you know, somebody to say that they, you know, I'm just thinking about the song. So when the song comes out and all those extra really special things come to you that you weren't expecting, or, then that always means a lot to you. You know, there's a lady that, named her daughter after me. I have a whole bunch of cats named after me, and so that kind of stuff, dogs, as a pet name, Macy Gray. So that kind of stuff, you know, you're not expecting. So when people tell you that kind of stuff, it, you know, it definitely makes you feel good inside, you know.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is the amazing and talented Macy Gray. Make sure to follow her on her Twitter account at Macy Gray's Life. Speaking of Twitter, Macy, I wanted to ask you if you are addicted to social media and do you love that you can connect with your fans that way? Because I remember, you know, back in the day, you know, when you wanted to be in contact with a celebrity, you sent off a letter and hoped for the best. But now your fans can actually send you a tweet and potentially you're seeing it.
Yeah, that's like the best, one of the best things that's ever happened to, you know, to music, to entertainment, I think. Because you, yeah, that's just it. You get, you know, your fans get to talk to you. Even if you don't always hit them back, you know, you get to, you know, you get to hear from them. And, you know, you get to, I've gotten to know a bunch of my fans through Twitter and Facebook, people that I would have never met before. And, you know, it means a lot to me and it means something to them. So I think it's genius, you know, as long as people don't abuse it and get crazy and start hacking people and, you know, but other than that, I think it's been a really good experience for everyone. And it's definitely a great source of information, you know, finding out what else is going on in the world, you know.
And are you a fan of one more than the other? Like, do you prefer Twitter to Facebook or Facebook to Twitter, or does it not matter to you?
I used to be all Facebook, but I mostly Twitter now just because it's a lot quicker than, I'm not a big Facebooker anymore. I used to be, but it's kind of like, I got busy was what happened. I got life.
You got a lot going on.
So I just, I don't use it as much. And then Twitter is like, you know, boom, 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 and you're done. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Okay. Now, you have recorded a lot of music. Do you have a favorite track that stands out to you of yours that you always enjoy hearing or performing?
Probably. What's cool now is I'm back to being loving doing I Try because it's 14 years later and people still know it, and that just blows my mind. Mm-hmm. And they still know like all the words, and that's pretty cool. So stuff like that is cool, but I have a bunch of, I'm a big fan of mine, you know. I like my stuff.
That's awesome. That's awesome, because I know a lot of artists don't like to hear their own stuff because it's either they're too critical of it or they've heard it and performed it too much that they don't like to listen when it's sort of off hours, if you will.
Yeah, I know. I have a friend that told me that once, but I didn't believe her. I thought she was just saying that. just saying cool. I don't really believe that. I think artists listen to themselves obsessively. You know?
Okay.
Especially if you're critical of it, you're listening to it, you know, trying to figure out what you know what I mean? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. People say that, you know, the same sound artistic, but I don't believe that.
That's awesome. You know, you've got to work with so many great artists and producers. Is there an artist or producer right now that you would love to collaborate with and do a song with, or a producer that you're like, hey, I like what that person's doing?
Oh, yeah, there's really a lot of great music coming out. I love Kendrick Lamar, I love his record, and I liked, what else? Oh, God, why can't I think of anybody? I just said I love it, and then I can't think of them. There's a lot of really good records out there. Wait a second. Oh, my God. I really like, of course, like everybody else, I love that new Robin Thicke.
Right, Blurred Lines, yeah.
Artist called Laura Movado that I really like, and there's a ton. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank right now, but yeah,
okay.
There's a lot of good stuff out.
Now, speaking of some of the artists that are out there now and the young ones that are sort of doing their thing and coming up, is there any young artist out there, especially because you've been through the grind and you've been doing this for a while, is there any artist right now that you would love to pull aside and be like, listen here, you need to think about this?
No, because you know, mostly when you're a young artist, you don't listen to anybody because you're like on top of the world and you're young and you have a lot of money and you really don't listen. It's a kind of thing you got to learn for yourself, you know, like life, you know? You gotta, like, people tell you stuff, but you really gotta figure it out as you go.
And before I let you bounce, I wanted to ask you, what is up next for you in the next 8 to 12 months? Like, is there gonna be new songs coming out? I know you're probably gonna still be on the road, because that seems to be, like, what you do.
Yeah, I'm working on my next coming record now. It's actually a duet project with Jason Hill. He's a producer. He used to be in a band called Louis XIV, and we did a EP together. It's just me and him wrote all the songs and did all the music and the singing and kind of like a Eurythmics kind of thing. And it's called The New, and that's coming out in the late fall. Actually, you should start hearing the single in about a month.
Okay. And would you ever write a book, Macy, like about your life or any of that? Do you have any, you know, passion to do that? Or is it going to be movies and acting and singing and recording?
Mostly that. And then I'm really interested in fashion. And I'm in the process of opening up a clothing store, but mostly what you said, you know.
That's fantastic. Well, Macy, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate your time, and you're such a talented artist, so thanks for hanging out with us.
All right, thank you.
That's Grammy Award-winning artist Macy Gray. Again, make sure to follow her on Twitter, at Macy Gray's Life.
Hey, this is Macy Gray. You are hanging out on the Kelly Alexander Show. Enjoy.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Online safety is just one of the major issues facing parents these days. With the recent tragic suicide of Amanda Todd in Canada, more and more young people seem to be coming forward with their stories of being cyberbullied. But how can parents safeguard their children against cyberbullying and cyberstalkers? Alexis Moore is the creator and founder of Crime Victim Organization and Advocate Network. This is the world's first online public safety virtual network, which unites crime victim agencies, law enforcement, and prosecutors from around the world, connecting resources and experts all in one virtual community. Alexis is also the president of Survivors in Action, a nonprofit crime victim organization. Having survived her own personal ordeal as a victim of stalking, Alexis makes it a priority to be a catalyst for change. Alexis Moore joins us to talk about what parents can do to protect their children against cyberstalking and cyberbullying. Alexis, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me. This is such an important topic. I'm happy to be here to talk about it.
Alexis, I guess the first question I would have is if there is a big difference between cyberbullying and cyberstalking.
You know, there really isn't. And ironically, cyberstalking is all-encompassing, and it does encompass cyberbullying because the intent of the perpetrator is really how it defines the crime, and that's to harass, annoy, humiliate, torture the victim. And regardless of how it's put, cyberbullying just tends to impact children, and cyberstalking impacts adults and children and encompasses cyberbullying. And the tragic thing about words and play on words is oftentimes someone hears the word cyberbullying and they don't think it sounds as horrific as stalking or cyberstalking. So it's my job as an expert and an advocate for victims to make sure that folks realize that cyberbullying is just as horrible as cyberstalking, and they're actually very similar because the intent of the perpetrator is the same. So regardless what we call it or how we spell it, it's something that we all need to pay close attention to and ensure that victims have the tools they need to overcome.
Can you explain to us what would qualify as cyberstalking? Because I think some people, you know, it might be happening to them and they're not sure that this is actually what's going on.
Sure. Cyberstalking is any use of technology with the intent to harass, manipulate, intimidate, or control the victim. And it can be any piece of technology utilized. So it can be anything from a run-of-the-mill fax machine to now social media, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, blogs, websites. Any use of technology with a purpose, intention only, not for any financial gain, but rather to torment the victim, harass them, annoy them, humiliate them, stalk them using technology. So that's the key, is just we're introducing technology into the mix. And it's been going on for a decade, maybe longer, but just recently with all of the news media and the changes globally to legislation, we're finally getting around to recognizing that cyberstalking is just as serious as stalking, and cyberbullying and cyberstalking both need to be addressed and victims need support.
What can people do if they are a victim of cyberstalking? How can they handle and protect themselves?
The first steps are start documenting immediately. Evidence is like anything, it becomes stale and it can disappear quickly, especially with the use of technology. So my advice as a survivor of cyberstalking as well as an advocate for victims and working thousands of cases, I have to say immediately, as horrible as it may be, get that evidence secure. And what I mean by get the evidence is start printing those web pages, taking screenshots, saving those emails, those text messages. And if you're not sure how to do any of this, consult with folks. Survivorsinaction.org. We're a national nonprofit crime victim agency that is here in the United States, but we do provide support to victims in Canada and anywhere around the world. So if you're in a position where you're just, wow, I don't know what to do or I feel overwhelmed, at least know that you need to immediately start collecting evidence and start documenting all of the incidents. And if you feel overwhelmed, start looking for help. And the help can come from an agency like Survivors in Action, or it can come from a neighbor, a family friend, a coworker. The key is just to start collecting that evidence and to start recording those incidents right away so that we can ensure that we get this activity acknowledged by law enforcement and that you get the help you need.
What can parents actually do, you know, to help their children from being a victim of, you know, cyberbullying and potentially cyber stalking?
Well, you know, the key is to remember that we cannot stop anyone permanently or anything permanently. So as hard as we work as a community to protect children online, it's still going to happen. So what we first have to do is just make our children aware that it exists and talk about it. As I say, communication is number one. So talking to kids about bullying and cyberstalking, using stories in the media like Amanda Todd and others as ways to introduce conversation is going to be key. Because, unfortunately, today, a parent's knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, I'm just not going to allow my child online, or I'm going to take him off Facebook, or I'm just not going to allow him to have access to anything. And that's a tragedy, because children need these tools to be able to function in society later in life, especially even today. They need the computer to do research for school projects and to complete assignments. So I hate to see that happen, where parents completely pull the plug on technology. So starting with communicating with them is vital. Just bring the subject up. My book, A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying, Simple Ways to Protect Your Children, as easy as 1, 2, 3. You can get that book, put it on the coffee table, and use it as a starting point for conversation and find out from your kids and their friends if they're being bullied or cyberbullied or if they know these things are happening. And that's the most important thing to do.
Joining us on the show is Alexis Moore, author of A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying. You can learn more about her at alexismoore.com. Is there any way to determine if you, your family, or your children are at a high risk of being a victim of cyberbullying or cyberstalking?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And one way to really analyze this is to look at it from an objective point of view. If you know that your child is visible online and that they're interacting with strangers, whether it be on social media sites or interacting on gaming sites or any technology without really identifying who they're interacting with, that's a high risk. And those are things that we tend to look out for and to encourage parents to discuss with their kids that they are potentially putting themselves in harm's way. And they really don't know if they're communicating with strangers who they are. It could be an adult. It could be a teen. It could be really who they say they are or not. So knowing who is in your social network and your technological network is very important. And that's something that we need to be considering right away if your child, for example, is involved in youth groups or online doing, participating in discussions or using the internet and interacting with folks they really don't know personally. This is a danger, and it's something that puts them at risk and should be discussed. And a lot of this has to do with just open communication, and I'm going to say it again, speak out. Speaking out about cyberbullying, talking about it, getting the kids to talk about it at any age, getting educators and officials to talk about it. Speaking out and telling the victims also to speak out and be brave and discuss if they are being victimized is going to be key to helping to harness this issue and start moving victims away from thinking that they're hopeless or helpless or that they have to turn to suicide or any other tragic event taking place. We want to stop that, and how we can do that is encouraging them to speak out and to be brave and to continue to speak out until they get help and support.
What's your position on kids and social media, you know, and how this could obviously impact them being cyberbullied? You know, do you think there's a certain age that kids should be before they get a Facebook or a Twitter account?
You know, it's going to vary on the maturity of the child and how much parental control is involved. You know, youngsters as young as 6, 7 years old have access to the internet and are out there using it and involved with social media. So what we have to think about as a community and parents and educators, caregivers, is where is my child developmentally wise? You know, are they capable of using good judgment online, or do we need to monitor their activities? When is a good age? You know, it's going to depend on the child's maturity and the parent's ability to see the potential warning signs and to be active in their child's online experience. You know, unfortunately, we are handing kids technology pretty young, and there's those out there that have iPhones and access to technology that I wouldn't have had access to at all because it didn't even exist when we were kids. So as parents out there listening to the show and thinking about this, it really is going to be a very subjective case-by-case, child-by-child, when and if you give them access and what type of access and how you put the limitations and how you control it is up to the parent, and they need to be thinking of these things. And sometimes you don't even think about it because you see their friends or they're doing it at school or it seems like it's safe enough because no one in the family has had any issue or it hasn't happened at our school kind of a thing. And so it's really important, though, with this recent news story with Amanda Todd and her case, as well as the many, many others, that we take a step back and we start thinking about what things we have done already and what we can do to protect our kids and what safeguards we can put in place to ensure their safety online.
The fact that you are someone who is an advocate for, or against, rather, cyber stalking and cyberbullying, do you find in your work experience that it's hard for you to get some people to take cyberbullying seriously? Like, I feel that there's still an attitude out there, although I feel it is getting better, that some people think, oh, it's really not that bad.
Exactly. It is troubling, to say the very least. Cyberbullying, cyber stalking, it's a very difficult situation to present to the public as being a threat or any real danger, especially today when acts of violence are rampant across the world and we're seeing so many violent acts being perpetrated everywhere. People tend not to think that technology is violent or technology can lead to death. And that's why I'm here to say that it is violent. It can lead to homicide, suicide, and that's the whole picture that we're trying to get our policymakers, parents, educators, and our entire global community aware of, that cyberbullying, cyberstalking is just as heinous as any other crime, and it needs to be taken seriously. But again, because of our difficult times and seeing the violence that we do, often you just don't think of tech being a real threat and take it seriously as it needs to be taken. So it is difficult, to answer your question, to find victims' help. And tragically, victim resources and educators and caregivers and civic groups, it's up to all of us to get together and unite and find ways to evolve so that we can serve and protect this community of individuals when they reach out for help. And I think that's been the biggest hurdle so far in the last decade, is getting folks to realize that we've got to evolve existing resources and make sure that we include the cyber stalking, bullying, and cyber bullying community, so that when folks do realize they are being bullied or cyber bullied or cyber stalked, that they have a resource to turn to for help. Because now we're promoting so much awareness, but we're really not offering any support. There is no place for these folks who realize they're being bullied, cyber bullied. They just don't know where to go, whether it be a parent or an educator. They just don't know what to do because it's very difficult to find help. So that's something that I'm working on very diligently.
Now, Alexis, you come from a place of understanding, because if I understand things correctly, you yourself were a victim of stalking. Is that why you decided to get involved in this, to help other people from what you've experienced?
Yes, it is. In 2004, I began a horrible cyber-stalking experience where technology was used to harass, manipulate, and literally torture me financially, as well as jeopardize my personal safety. And I reached out for help and was called crazy and told that, you know, by law enforcement and officials that they'd never heard of such a thing, and how could technology be used to stalk? And at that particular time, I had a choice. You know, I could either stand idle and hope that someone else would take the reins and get the cyber stalking awareness started, or I could do it myself. And I just decided it was time to take action and do what I could. I have my experience stems from being an investigator, locating people and assets using technology and all of that in my 9-to-5 life. So I was very fortunate that I understood a lot about technology. However, I just never realized that cyber stalking and the potential was there while working in the industry. And it just so happened that after being victimized, it just changed my life, but it changed it for the positive. The book stems, the Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying, is one of a personal nature. I happen to have utilized a web counter, and that tracks incoming and outgoing web traffic and a lot of keywords and that type of thing on my various websites for risk management and also for marketing purposes. And I kept seeing the words Alexis Moore suicide, Alexis Moore bully, and it was troubling and it really shook me up. And I ended up learning that an Alabama teen had committed suicide named Alexis Moore, of all things. And I felt that that was a message to me. And doing some research, I discovered there were not any parents' guides or information on cyberbullying or cyberstalking. And I decided at that point that I had done a lot of work with adults and families, and I had not yet come full circle and done a parent's guide or participated in that genre yet. So that's what led to the book. And 100% of the proceeds are being donated to support victims and to assist victims of bullying and cyberbullying. So I'm very happy to be able to contribute, but I wish it wasn't for those very reasons.
Now, something I wanted to touch upon as well, because it's very important, I think, to help, you know, victims get through this. What are some of, I guess, the biggest obstacles that cyberstalking victims need to overcome so that they can come out the other side and lead, you know, healthy and productive lives?
Well, feeling isolated is the number one. Because it's a technological attack, it happens without leaving any broken bones or bruises for anyone else to see. So a lot of times a victim feels isolated, and because they don't have that physical injury to report or to say to a doctor or teacher or to even their parent, hey, I am hurt, that puts a very big boundary in place of victims being able to overcome. And then the response, unfortunately, because there really is no place for a victim to turn to for help, it becomes very difficult. And what I mean by that is there is not yet an official cyberbully, cyberstalk resource in every place where a victim or a caregiver or an educator can refer or go to for help and get direct support. There's lots of foundations that offer literature and are legislatively active, but finding that direct help is very, very difficult. So we have to be creative and utilize what is existing and what we do have. And in the schools, there's peer counselors, there's child psychologists, and there's you know, all kinds of advocates and such with crime victim agencies. So what we're trying to do is get these groups to understand that we have a role in this, and we can be sure that victims do not feel isolated and they do have places to turn for direct support, but it's going to require participation by these groups. So civic groups and churches, schools, officials, you name it, all of us, crime victim agencies, charities, we're going to have to evolve and ensure that this particular group of folks has a place to turn to for help, so that these victims that are isolated now do have a place to turn where people will understand and give them the support and the tools they need to overcome.
Alexis, before I let you go, what would be your biggest piece of advice to someone who is undergoing, you know, cyberbullying or cyberstalking? Because, again, I think it's important that they know where to head to first.
Be brave and speak out. If we can just remember those four words, if you're a victim or if you know of someone who may be a victim of cyberbullying or cyberstalking, the first thing you need to say is be brave and speak out. Because unless you speak out, and you may have to speak out many times, and that's why I'm saying as a victim survivor of cyberstalking that it's going to require a lot of work and perhaps it's going to be very difficult. But be brave and speak out so you can overcome, so we can get you those tools and so that we can get you the help you need so you're not isolated and alone. Because obviously there are many out there right now who may be listening, even parents right now listening, who may not know what to do. And parents, this applies to you as well. Be brave and speak out. Reach out for help, because we can't help you unless we have you reach out and communicate with us.
Fantastic. Alexis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Alexis Moore, again, author of A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying. Make sure to check out her website, alexismoore.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Life has a way of throwing us curveballs, and often when we least expect it, learning to cope and adapt to these changes aren't always as quick and easy as we would like them to be. Today on the show, we welcome Ariane de Bonvoisin, who is the CEO and founder of First 30 Days, which helps guide people through all types of changes, both personal and professional. Ariane has lived in 6 different countries on 3 different continents, learned to speak 4 languages, and went to 5 different schools, all before the age of 18. She is no stranger to change and the anguish that can sometimes come along with it. Ariane, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be on.
At what point and why did you decide to create this platform to help guide people through their various situations?
So, Kelly, I had worked in the corporate world for about 10, 12 years, and I think like a lot of people, I wasn't very happy there. I knew I wasn't sort of doing what my soul wanted to do. I sort of felt like I'd climbed the wrong ladder. And as hard as it is to sort of leave a job, I sort of, you know, prayed and got down on my knees and asked for courage. And eventually I left that sort of image of a very external, perfect life. And the thing that was most missing for me was that I didn't really feel I was making a difference. I wasn't really feeling like what I was doing was adding any value or contribution. And I went off and I started traveling. And one of the things I realized was that actually every single person you meet is going through some sort of life change. They're either dealing with a tough change, you know, health diagnosis or divorce or a death in a family. They're either thinking about making a change, you know, they want to change careers, they want to, you know, have a child or pursue a dream, or they're helping someone else through a change. And then on the flip side, I always heard, you know, change is hard, I hate change, I never want to go through change again. And I thought, isn't it amazing that this change business is so hard, people, you know, avoid it, and yet it's the one constant guarantee in life. And none of us have ever really been taught how to get through it, how to navigate it. And I thought, you know, I've been through my fair share of changes, as you know. And I thought, well, why don't I interview a good 1,000 people or so and just get a sense of why is it that some people get through change and some people have such a hard time? Why is it that some people make those changes they always want and some people never do? And that's sort of the seed of the idea. I didn't know what it was going to become. The seed of the idea was there, and I ended up publishing a book where I detail these 9 principles of change that sort of bubbled up through these interviews. And then people were like, you need to do a website. And so on the website, first30days.com, there's 60 different life changes. So everything you could possibly imagine, from the first 30 days of a divorce, first 30 days of a baby, first 30 days of living spiritually, first 30 days of starting a business. And I sort of went and found experts and other people who'd been through those changes. So it was really, it was a dream to sort of make a difference and also go with something that I loved. I love people. I love change. I love, you know, I wanted to sort of help people have their lives turn out differently.
Why do you think it's so hard for us to sometimes accept, you know, that change is coming or that it's actually already here? I find some people just super dig in their heels.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think all of us at some levels, because we're all human beings, I think we're wired for certainty. I think we're wired to be in control. We're wired to do whatever makes us feel safe. And change doesn't go with any of those things. So change really threatens all of those. I think we prefer to find our confidence in our home and our job and our partner and our kids and our money. And then beyond that, we don't really want anything to change. And a lot of us actually prefer the familiar, even though we might be suffering tremendously in a job we hate, in a relationship that's not right, because change appears to bring up so much anguish because it does mean the unknown, a lot of us dig in our heels. And I think what change shows us is that, you know, we're not in control and that there is this thing called life, which is going to bring people in our life and take things away and bring work and often take it away as well. So change sort of digs into our core identity, which is, I just want to be safe. And just want to be safe often means I don't really want anything too much to change, because what we don't know at the time when we're going through change is that change actually usually also brings good things. But we've been wired to think that, you know, change is bad.
Have you noticed that, you know, it feels like sometimes people think when they're going through a change, like they're the only one that this is, you know, happening to, and it's very frustrating and I guess they feel very isolated. How can people try to get themselves out of that mentality?
Well, I think, you know, when we're going through a change, what it often does is it rocks our confidence. It you know, our self-esteem comes tumbling down. You know, if we got fired or dumped or whatever it is, put on weight, can't quit smoking. And I think a lot of change, you know, sometimes brings an introversion, like you want to go inside. You don't really want to reach out for help. You don't really want to share your change with other people. You go into, you know, the classic, I'm alone. No one has ever felt this bad. No one has ever cried so much on the couch. No one has ever eaten so much ice cream. And we sort of disconnect from realizing that actually everyone has gone through so many similar changes. It's just we keep them so close to our vest in some ways. And I think, you know, this is definitely one of the principles, the 9 principles of change, is people who are good at change, you know, they're not alone. They have a change support team. They do reach out. And there is a time for being alone, and there is a time for sort of going inwards. But everyone I met got through a change because someone else was there for them. And the interesting thing is very often it's not the people you think. It's not your family. You know, sometimes your family are just as rocked as you are because of your change. Sometimes it's brand new people that come into your life while you're going through a change who don't have a sense of who you are or who you were or what you used to be. And they very often sort of can help you see yourself differently because, you know, you don't dig in your heels and go, well, I am this person. This is my identity. So I always find life provides sort of new people, people who are there to listen, people who do want you to get through a change. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, letting people in. We all know how good it feels when we're helping someone else. And so it's just letting people be there for us as well. There's always someone around.
How can people try to find motivation to make or create that change that occasionally, you know, they desperately want? Like sometimes people actually, you know, they might be scared of it, but they need it or want it to happen.
Yeah, I mean, motivation is probably sort of the big question. Again, what I've found through my research and just all the talks I've given and being around so many people now who are going through changes, most people get stuck on motivation because of, you know, not really knowing why they want to change. They're kind of in this sort of no man's land. They're kind of in this like, well, it's not that bad. Yeah, the relationship, it's not that bad. And the weight, it's not that bad. And this job, it's not that bad. And so there's not a very strong reason why. And what I found is the people who really get through a change, they're very clear on their why they need to stop smoking, why they need to lose weight, why they need to, you know, take some time off work and be with their family. So the first thing I would say is if you really are looking for motivation, ask yourself, well, why, and then whatever the change is about. And sort of really dig in and sort of have that be, you know, something that is really important. You know, why is it that women lose weight before their wedding? Because they've got a really strong reason why. Why do people stop smoking when they're pregnant? They have a really strong reason why. And before that, there's nothing that would have done it. So that's sort of one thing. And then the other motivation, again, to come back to what we spoke in the previous question, is involve people, involve your friends. Like, you know, have them hold you accountable, verbalize the change you want to make, let them get in your face, let them motivate you, let them encourage you, let them check in with you, let them put a deadline on you in case you don't get through your change. But it's way too easy to sort of make a little commitment to yourself in your head or in your journal and then, you know, hide it from the world. And, well, it's not so bad if you don't get it. So the more, you know, involve your colleagues, involve your family who's really going to kick your bum, and just sort of, you know, let people sort of want the change with you. You know, it's one of the biggest things I could probably say is, well, who's around you? Who wants you to change?
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Ariane de Beauvoisin, author of The First 30 Days, Your Guide to Making Any Change Easier. Make sure to check out her website, first30days.com. Ariane, I actually want to talk about, you know, this 30 days, because obviously it's, you know, a title in your book. It's also a part of the title of your website. So how important is this first 30 days?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. I think everything actually gets decided in the first 30 days. If you look at the changes people want to make, so that, you know, there's two categories, the changes you initiate and the changes sort of life throws at you. If you look at the changes you initiate, so many people quit before the first 30 days. You know, you think about New Year's is up around the corner. Most people's resolutions, they don't even get to sort of halfway. It's sort of in the first 30 days that everything from your beliefs, your motivation, your courage, your faith, you know, all of that stuff gets tested. And sort of your discipline, sort of, it's either there or it's not there. You know, why you choose to go for this change. I mean, not to get, you know, scientific and psychological, but there's plenty of studies that show it takes 28 to 30 days for the brain, the actual neocortex in the brain, to get comfortable with a new habit. Something has changed. It's not in the first week. The brain's going to go, this is kind of new and fun and interesting. But it's only when you start getting up to 28 to 30 days that the brain actually settles into a new groove or a new habit. I think also when, you know, the other category of change where life throws something at you, it's in the first 30 days that you are going to make up your mind about what this means. Is life against you? Are you unlucky? Are you a victim? Are you a martyr? Did bad things happen to you? So the story you attach right from the beginning is actually the story you're going to start living into. The beliefs that you have about, well, what does this change actually mean, you know, are going to be very self-evident when you get into the first 30 days. If you resist the change, it's going to be the strongest in the first 30 days. You know, most people who are good at change, they get to a point of accepting that this change has happened. So you get back into sort of the flow. So the first 8 days is as much of a metaphor of actually just getting started in the right way. It's sort of which direction are you pointed in? And it's also, you know, an ability to let the physical body, the emotional body, even the spiritual body just catch up with the change that you're either intending or the change that life is actually wanting you to look at now.
Do you find older people have a harder time at change? And I'm not talking about necessarily, you know, people in 70s or 80s. I think we all know that sometimes they're very set in their routine. But it's interesting how sometimes I think people in their 20s are better at change, you know, but then sometimes I think when you're in your 30s, you understand what was going on. So you might be more accepting of change then as well.
Yep. Again, I would say it's a little bit of both. I would be able to say it sort of categorically. I think as we get older, we do, you know, we realize we've got a change resume. We've been through a fair share of changes. And we realize that, you know, life is sort of part of this. We're not just the only ones that's going to be in control. So we can sort of not only relax into life sort of throwing things our way, but we also sort of know what we're made of. You know, I talk about this concept of the change muscle. And the change muscle does get stronger over time because you're building up these references and this database inside of you of, you know, I'm the girl that got through this, or I'm the guy that witnessed this and had to initiate this and get this done. So that change muscle does get stronger over time. What I have found also on the flip side is the older we get, the more excuses we tend to also sometimes have. You know, I'm too old, or I'm not qualified, or I didn't have an education in this, or it's going to take time. You know, this change, it's not in my nature. So it sort of goes both ways. It's sort of, you know, when we're younger, sometimes we have a lot less excuses. When we're older, sometimes we can actually just sort of go, you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. So it sort of goes differently with different people.
It's kind of fascinating, and I just wanted to bring this up. For example, my mother, who my listeners know as Mummy Alexander, she hates the internet. Like she, you know, she does use a computer for work, but that's like a financial-based program, and it's very set, and that's the way it is. And for years, I've tried to get her, you know, into like exploring, because she likes to cook. I'm like, Mom, there's tons of recipes there that you can check out, like all this kind of stuff. But she just does not like it. Like she'd rather be outside if she has any free time. Anyways, lo and behold, about a month ago, she decides that she wants to now really be proactive about learning how to navigate the internet and like learning how to email properly and like all this kind of stuff. And it's funny how I think part of it is because she doesn't want to be left behind because she sees her grandkids that are, you know, on fire and 6 years old. And also, I think it's also because we got her an iPad and it seems much easier for her. Like she's not, you know, having to, you know, there's apps, it's much easier to navigate. But it's weird how this shift in her mind has just opened her up to all these different experiences. Mm-hmm.
Do you know, the point that you bring up there for me is that people will do more for other people than they will for themselves. So, for example, she'll do it for her grandkids. She'll do it to stay connected to you. She'll do it to be part of something else. You know, I had the same thing. I gave my mother an iPad. She's now on Skype and kids. And it's sometimes we will change for others much more than we'll just sort of do it for ourselves.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this. What happens when a person really wants to make a change and, you know, is ready to take that leap, but might be unable to do it at that particular time because of, you know, financial reasons or maybe family responsibilities? How would you guide them to continue reaching for that specific, you know, goal of change when it could be several months or maybe even years away?
Sure. And I would say, you know, one of the biggest myths is that we think change happens instantly and quickly and in a few days or a few weeks. People who are good at change have a much longer sort of runway to actually get a change. If there are people who get their New Year's resolutions, they give themselves 3 months, 6 months, even a year. And if you see it that way, things actually, you know, manifest that way. What I would say to your question is, what I've found is the most important changes we make in our life are actually, they're not dependent on financial or family or career or age or anything. The most important changes we make are internal changes. What do I mean by internal changes? This is, there's things like your self-esteem, your beliefs, your energy, your faith, your enthusiasm, your courage, your discipline, decreasing your disapproval, your negative voice inside yourself, how you see yourself. So all change is internal. I know it appears like they're external changes, but all changes is about how you see yourself internally. And for people who, you know, have financial issues or can't particularly get up and walk and, you know, they want to sort of maintain all of their financial and family responsibilities, I would say you can start right now doing some of that inner work. Catch your disapproval, you know, catch how many times you beat yourself up. Catch when you compare yourself, catch the excuses that come up. Start looking at your beliefs around starting a business or around money and is making money hard. All of that is available to anyone. It doesn't depend on anything outside, because all change is identity change. You know, it's how and who I am being in the world. And a lot of times people think, oh my God, this change is taking so long, and it's because their inner hasn't shifted. And when the inside shifts, the external shifts very quickly. So for people who have stuff going on, start doing the inner work, journal, do sort of really some personal development. And then when you are ready to jump, you'll be amazed how quickly the external is going to follow.
What's your most important thought, I guess, or piece of advice, you know, for people when they are going through a major life change?
You know, I'm going to sound repetitive, but you've got to get around other people, you know, whether it's a positive life change, you know, which we forget about. You know, we always think change is always the negative stuff, but the most wonderful things that have ever happened in your life have also happened because something has changed. And so change gets a bad rap because we always just remember the really tough ones. But I would say definitely get around other people. And then the other thing I found with people who really are going through tough life changes is, you know, the energy is very directed to you. It's, you know, you've lost your job, or you have this issue going on, or you know, it's very me driven. And I think one of the things that is best to sort of get back into the flow and back into being connected with life and others is to just do anything for someone else. Even if it's just, you know, a small thing, I'm not talking about volunteering, but just to realize that, you know, there's a world out there and there are other people. And, you know, you are still a mother, a sister, a daughter, a best friend. You are still working. To sort of broaden out, you know, your perspective of what actually might have happened to you. So to me, it's a combination of both. You know, get back into being connected. Go, you know, help out in any particular way that you can. Who else needs my help right now? And sort of get around other people.
I think that, you know, people, as you go through life, you meet other people and all that sort of stuff, and you realize that some people seem to be better at change than others. In your experience of interviewing all these types of different people, have you noticed a characteristic trait that separates someone who is easily adaptable to change versus someone who sort of, you know, puts their feet in the cement and is like, no, I'm not doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the very first and second principle of change in the book. And, you know, all the experts on the website would agree. People who are good at change are optimistic. People who are good at change have positive beliefs. They believe, you know, life is on their side. Even though I don't like what's happening, life is conspiring for my good. You know, they believe in what I call the change guarantee. The change guarantee is, from this change, something good will come. You don't know when, you don't know what it looks like or in what form, but when you can plug your mind into actually going in that direction, it's amazing how quickly the gift and what is positive about this change that might have been incredibly difficult reveals itself. And so, you know, the number one thing when I coach people, when I speak to people, my antenna go up and I start listening to their language, their beliefs, what they think about themselves, what they think about life, what they think about other people. And I can tell, are they a change optimist or are they a change pessimist? You know, I teach this to kids. Kids get it immediately. You know, it's like, what is it that you're focusing on? Because what you're focusing on, the negative of the change, believe it or not, expands. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's the character trait. If there's one, it's sort of, it's catching the negativity. You know, we all have it to some level, but it's catching it, choosing, and reaching for a more positive thought.
Fantastic. That's amazing. And where can people get a copy of your book?
So the book is available on Amazon, any major bookstores, and of course off the website as well, so first30days.com. It's available as an ebook. There's a couple other books there that I've written that you guys can go find out. It's available in French right now in Canada, so any French speakers as well.
Awesome. Ariane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Kelly. It was a real pleasure.
That was Ariane de Bonvoisin. Again, for more information or tips or any of that sort of good stuff, make sure to check it out on her website, first30days.com.
Bring on the remix.
rivers to get where you were. Travel the night riding on a shooting star. Was lonely then, like an alien. Had to get used to the world I was on, while yet still unsure if I knew where I belong.
The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for taking a look back at the year that was on The Kelly Alexander Show, and a big thank you going out to my guests, Macy Gray, Alexis Moore, and Ariane de Bonvoisin. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Anita Septimus. You don't choose the day you enter the world, and you don't choose the day you leave. It's what you do in between that makes all the difference. We're very excited as we launch into 2014. Lots of great interviews and segments coming your way, so make sure you hang tight with us throughout the year. And again, you can always check out what's going on our social media, at K Alexander on Twitter, of course our Facebook page, Kelly Alexander Show, and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Have a great week, and you and I will chat soon.